Good evening. My name is Peter Berg. I'm head of special collections here in the MSU libraries, and I'd like to welcome you to another semester of the Michigan Writers Series. Thank you for coming out on such a snowy, cold evening. Before we begin with this evening's festivities, I'd just like to make a couple of announcements regarding the Michigan Writers Series. First of all, we have up here at front a schedule of the writers that will follow Arthur Versluys this semester for the Michigan Writers Series, so I hope you'll pick one of those up and come out when you can. They are usually on, well, every Friday night, not every Friday night. They are on most Friday nights during the semester, and of course the dates are right there on the schedule for you. We think we have a very nice lineup. In fact, on February 9th, Dennis Henriksen, a poet from Lansing, and Jay Featherstone, who teaches in the College of Education here at MSU, will be giving a poetry reading. As with all of our presentations here for the Michigan Writers Series, this is being taped and will eventually be put on the internet so that the world will hear what Arthur Versluys has to say. All of our past events for the Michigan Writers Series have been put up on the internet as well. There's a website that you can go check those out if you want. So if any of your friends or parents ask, what are you doing on a Friday night in East Lansing, you can say, I was at in the library, no less, listening to Arthur Versluys, and you can check it out for yourself on the internet. There is a sign-up sheet here that we have, and we'd like you, if you wish, to put your name and address and email address down so that we can stay in touch with you and inform you about events coming up for the Michigan Writers Series. We'd be happy to send you brochures and any other information that we might have. Tonight's guest is Professor Arthur Versluys. He is a true Michigan writer. He was born and raised in Grand Rapids, went to Grand Valley State University for his undergraduate education, and then received his PhD from the University of Michigan. In addition to his teaching, he serves as the editor of Esoterica, the Journal of Esoteric Studies. He is the author of Island Farm, which is published by Michigan State University Press, and many other books. This year, he is the acting director of Royal, and Royal is the residential options in arts and letters here at Michigan State, in addition to his duties as associate professor in the Department of American Thought and Language. Of his work, one critic has said, Arthur Versluys has created a Walden of our time. I have read no other book, this is referring to Island Farm, that captures so poignantly the transition from agriculture to economics that now so bedevils us. In finely honed, thoughtful prose, the author takes us on a journey into a vanished America where the seasons were once the ultimate legislature. Island Farm is indeed a triumph. Please join me in welcoming Arthur Versluys.
Well, I'd like to thank everybody for coming out here, and I'd also like to thank Peter Berg and MSU Libraries for setting this up. And really, what I'd like to do is talk about a couple different things. One is the genesis of the book itself, Island Farm, and where I, where I'm coming from in terms of my own background in relation to the book, and how the book came about exactly. So I wanted to start with that, and then there are a couple other things I'd like to touch on. One is really the question of how things in terms of farming from the time when my great-grandfather, Jacobus James, came to the United States and came to West Michigan and started to farm just after the Civil War, and our own time, how have things not changed in terms of farming? Because I started to do some research on this, and I dug up some kind of interesting things, and so I wanted to share some of that with you. But then I also wanted to talk about how things have changed. So really, those are the, because they've changed rather markedly in certain respects. And so I wanted really to deal with those three primary topics. In terms of the first, my background and the book Island Farm, most of that book was actually written in Germany. I wrote it in Germany because when I was living there on a Fulbright, I felt, it was the first time I had lived that long away from Michigan, and so I felt a certain nostalgia, and a certain feeling, a pull, and actually dreamed about the family farm. And so that was what really got the book in its first draft. I come from a family farm on the west side of Grand Rapids, and the family farm, as I said, was founded by my great-grandfather, Jacobus James, and then it went through the family to my grandfather, Peter, and then to the four brothers who are now farming it. So the book is really about, it's about the family, but it's also about the land. And if you look at if you read the beginning of the book, you'll notice that it begins with a preface that actually was written later in the coffee shop. And it begins with the relationships of the people on the family farm. And so it's a book that celebrates the relationships, and I would say really unique relationships that emerge on a family farm, my family's farm. But it also, in the part of the book that follows that, focuses on the landscape itself. And that's really deliberate. I deliberately chose that, because those are the two layers of the family farm in a way. Now, this book is also unusual as a farming book, and I'll just say this. It's unusual as a book about farming because it's also about philosophy and literature. There are a lot of literary allusions and other things that kind of make their way through the book. And so on one hand, you can read it straight through as being about the dogs and the, you know, the different characters who work on the farm and, you know, the people who've passed through and the animals that live on it and so forth. But then on the other hand, it also has these other layers that you can find if you want, and particularly in rereading, these things emerge. So those are some general comments about the book. And about the origins of the book and my own family. A couple of other things I wanted to mention about it, and that is Island Farm was written during a period when I was also working on another trilogy of books. Island Farm is itself one of three books. It's the first. And it's the book that really was meant to reach out to a general audience and explain what it's like to grow up on a family farm, and in particular, orchards, and the kind of life to explain to 99% of American society does not live on a family farm, certainly of this kind. And so there's a real cause in doing that, and I chose this time to bring that out. But I have two other books that are planned over a period of time to come out that will complement Island Farm. And at the same time I was doing that, incidentally, that book, I was also at work in Germany on another book, which I have up on the table here, called Wisdom's Book. And Wisdom's Book is the third of a trilogy of books on Christian esotericism, which is another of my interests. Particular form of Christian mysticism, which actually, believe it or not, appears in Island Farm. Some of the figures and some of the ideas emerge in there. But Wisdom's Book came out this past year, so you have the final book in a trilogy coming out at the same time that the first book in this series on farming came out. And they were all written really around the same time, that is the Island Farm and the books on Christian theosophy. So those are some general remarks about the, you know, how the book came about. I also wanted to talk a little bit about the whole way that farming today, and family farming, at least in my own experience, my family's experience, is really similar to what was going on when my great-grandfather came here, because I started doing some research in regards to some other reading that I was doing about what it was like in Michigan in 1875, during that period. And I started reading, actually, in the library here, Horticultural Society reports. And there's a treasure trove of information. You won't believe what's in horticulture. You won't believe it. When I start reading to you some of these horticultural reports, you will know what I'm talking about, okay? But really, my thesis here is how things have not changed. Because I started doing this research, you know, and in some ways, obviously, things have changed, and in some amusing ways, things have changed. For example, in the 1870s and 1880s, if you read travelers' reports, what do they talk about? Well, one of the things they talk about is eating, Midwestern eating habits. Okay, what was it like to come to the Midwest from Europe? Well, the first thing people noticed was that people from the Midwest would have the most incredible eating habits. They would eat an entire meal in 5 minutes. And people like Charles Dickens would travel through the Midwest. And actually, I've got a quote here from Charles Dickens. This is what Charles Dickens says. Novelist Charles Dickens, he came up to the upper Midwest, and he said he soon came to dread the dinner gong. He said, "Never in my life did I see such a listless, heavy dullness as brooded over these meals. The recollection of it weighs me down and makes me wretched. I dreaded the coming of the hour that summoned us to table and was as glad to escape from it as if it had been a penance." So that was Charles Dickens' view of Midwestern eating habits. Well, Midwesterners ate like incredible amounts of food. They would eat huge amounts of steak soaked in butter. This was the standard meal, right? And they ate in 1842. You can imagine how French visitors saw this. In 1842, they wrote about this, how Midwesterners would eat huge amounts in incredibly short periods. Now, why would I mention that? Right? My sister clocked my family from when she was young. This is absolutely true. She clocked my family from the prayer until dessert, and it was 6 minutes. Okay? That is a fact, all right? And that is not in 1880. I'm not 120 years old. There is some continuity. So if you wondered where the Simpsons on TV got their eating habits, if you've seen the Simpsons eat, okay, they are truly Midwesterners, all right? So now you see how agrarianism has influenced American culture. So, okay, what else would they have noticed other than the incredible eating habits? They would have noticed hogs. There were hogs running through towns quite frequently. And this became, in publicity in Europe, this appeared in the following way. Farming in America was said, and this is in a letter that was circulated as a way to get people to the U.S. In 1880, roughly. Farming is child's play in the Midwest. This is Michigan, right? Michigan farming is child's play. Crops spring up spontaneously in this garden of the world. Hogs, ripe for the slaughter, are so kind and accommodating to visitors that they approach the barnyards not to be fed but to be butchered. So these wild hogs are running around and they run up to your door saying, "Kill me." You know, this is the kind of depiction. Now, the thing is, the hogs running wild actually does appear in a lot of travelers' accounts. So, and the third thing that appears is rutted roads. Rutted, dirty roads, dirty conditions, very difficult conditions. And I mentioned some of these things have obviously changed. One of the things that you get from this period and that I gathered from the research was an immense sense of admiration for the people who, during this period, were doing incredible amounts of work. Now, I grew up in a family that, and this, you see this in the book, that are just working fools. I mean, that's a fact, okay? And you see that also in the 1880s, 1870s, back in the period of my great-grandfather, and certainly earlier than that. But the people who were single-handedly, essentially putting in a road with a team of horses, which my grandfather did, or trying to drain swampland. Island Farm, the book, it's called Island Farm because it was all swamp. That swamp had to be drained by hand, and so in order, the farm is up on high ground above the swamp. That's where the orchards are. You need a very specific, unique kind of ground. Immense amount of labor to do this kind of thing, and you get a real sense of that in reading settlers' accounts of just the terrific labor that this involves, and that is something that continues in farmers in general, I would say, are working fools, and that's something that continues to the present. It's just that, and this is foreshadowing of things to come later in the talk, there just ain't so many of them anymore. But I'll get to that in a bit. Okay, So what kind of stuff did I find when I was reading through these horticultural journals, right? What was going on in 1880, you know, when the family first 15 acres, my great-grandfather Jacobus got this first 15 acres of really crappy land, which is absolutely true. It was poor land. It was poorest land in the whole area. It's quite unbelievable that we're now the last one. We're almost the last ones. There's one farm that's going to become, I've got it written down here, Blossom Trails subdivision. And down the street is Apple Ridge Apartments, and so on. But in any case, we're the last ones, or almost the last ones. It's quite amazing that the farm's still there, and that it's grown to, you know, at least a modest size, and still is intact. We've never sold land. That is the farming family. Okay, so anyway, what has not changed? All right, you go back and you read these 1880s, you know, horticultural society meetings, and these guys get together, and women too, they get together, and they, you know, they talk about, you know, the farming situation, and they tell other farmers what they ought to do, and nobody listens to them. That's pretty much, you know, the way it seems to go in here, and I'll give you some examples of that. Number one, the need for organization and unions, okay? Now, does this sound familiar or what, okay? In 1890, Roland Morrill, this is a Michigan fruit grower, wrote about need for regulating false, unscrupulous fruit sellers. Michigan was notorious for this, by the way. Not the growers, but these people who would sell, and they'd sell crummy fruit with good stuff on top and ship it off to Chicago where they couldn't tell the difference. Well, anyway, so he was talking about that as a problem. And then he'd say, he's telling the other farmers, okay, we presume a great many of us have become tired of the advice to organize for mutual benefit in selling our products, but sooner or later we're going to be forced to do so as a matter of self-preservation unless some radical changes are made. Okay, this is 111 years ago, okay, and I can tell you from direct personal experience that organization, unionization, you know, does not really set very well. Farmers tend to be very independent-minded. It was true in 1890, they were calling, and I've got other examples here, you know, of this. Farmers, Frank Beatty in 1914, this is around the time that my grandfather was taking over the farm, and he was right around that time, he was selling strawberries, and I have his strawberry, I have a chit. It's a chit that he gave to the pickers from the strawberry operation that he had. So there's another Michigan grower in here, Frank Beatty, Three Rivers, and he was growing fine strawberries. And I love the story. He kept growing these really good strawberries, and then the market, okay, again, deja vu. Guess the exact same thing happens to us. You grow really fine strawberries, and then you put them out on the market, and then the market price collapses, and the price just becomes diddly, and so you're completely at the mercy of this market. And Frank Beatty in 1914 got really sick of that, and he said he had had it. And so he wrote a letter to each of these dealers and said, forget you, the price is going to be 15 cents a quart and not a penny less. And they started to complain when the price started to drop, and they were still paying 15 cents. And he said, I grow a good crop, and that's it. It's going to stay at 15 cents, and you're going to pay it. And he says in the Horticulturalist Journal, well, they did it. They paid, you know. And so then he says, let us grow a class of fruit that will, this is to other growers, that will attract the buyer, and then we may name our own price. So 1914, you know, farmers are trying to name their own price, actually, an example of that also is in 1964. Farmer wrote a book, actually he was an ex-farmer at that time, but he wrote a book called Yes, We Can Save the Family Farm! Which is here in the library. And it's quite a good book, actually. I enjoy it. And his argument is exactly the same. 1964, farmers must organize. We must control prices, you know. It isn't happening. Prices for apples for this past year were the worst they've ever been. At one point we got from a packer, you get these checks back, and I guess it's safe to say we got back from a packer a check for $3.67 for one tub of apples. Okay, that's 20 bushel. All right. That gives you an idea. Now, that was a unique situation because of charges and things like that, but that gives you an idea of that you can't make money at that. And so the advice to set your own price is still a serious problem, right? Okay, two, diseases. In Southwest Michigan, you've got a disease that's wiping out apple crops, right? It's wiping out trees. It's fire blight. Now, H.P. Henry is writing about this almost 100 years ago. And he says, fire blight disease is a considerable problem that was known 5,000 years ago in China. And he talks about its characteristics and notes how to protect orchards by trimming it out. And that's what farmers are doing. We have problems with fire blight. It's a disease that looks like fire. It looks like the limbs are on fire. They've been burned, right? It's extremely destructive, and it's very difficult to get rid of it. Okay? And actually, there's been disaster aid brought to Michigan because of that. So this is one of the difficulties that they were facing in the past. Exact same difficulty. Then again, how do you, in new sprays, different sprays, you know, we're looking toward, you know, nowadays people are looking toward more organic sprays and different kinds of sprays. And in particular, in my family, we're also using a kind of spray that's derived from a particular kind of plants, pyrethrins, right? We're using pyrethrins as an insecticide. All right. In 1880, Webster Childs advised the Michigan fruit grower that you should fight codling moths using sticky bands. Right? We use sticky bands. You put bands up. You catch the right. Does this sound familiar? He's talking about liquid. C.V. Riley is saying we should use a liquid insect poison. It's called pyrethrins, right? This is 1880, page 137 of the Horticultural Society thing. He says, the great argument in favor of pyrethrum is its harmless nature as affecting man and other mammals, other animals of the mammalian branch. When breathed, pyrethrins are no more disagreeable than any vegetable dust. I fed it to the neighbor's dog and regret to state that the dog is still alive and barks at all hours. Also, the school systems are all screwed up, by the way. That's another thing from these that you learn. They're very worried about the public school systems. New varieties of fruit, different varieties of fruit. They're talking about that. Actually, I mention it because I've actually planted a small orchard, and the orchard is made of the very varieties they're talking about, which now are retro. For example, Wagner, strawberry apples, Pippins, Tallman sweets. So, you know. Oversupply. All right, now we're moving transition. Okay, this is the transitional part of the talk here. Because in 1914, a Mr. Farnsworth wrote that the problem farmers, fruit growers face is not that they need a man who can teach them how to grow 2 bushels of apples where they previously grew one, but rather a man who can teach them how to sell 2 bushels where they previously sold one. That sounds real familiar to contemporary situation. G.T. Hayes wrote, we have 70 million barrels of apples to be eaten this year, 3 bushels a barrel. What does 70 million barrels mean? It means if all the crops were barreled and put in boxcars and these cars were coupled onto a train and the train were run by the MC station here at 30 miles an hour, we would stand here for 5 days, 24 hours a day before the harvest would go past and they would reach from here to San Francisco and then halfway to Honolulu. These have to be eaten before the next season. Okay, so you get a sense that there was this oversupply problem. And lo and behold, guess what we've got today? It's not an oversupply of apples, actually. You know, in this state, we have fewer and fewer apple farmers, so it isn't a local oversupply. It's the fact that the Chinese, actually, specifically the Chinese, other countries as well, but the Chinese have had apple production increase about 1,200% in the last 5 years. And almost all of that is exports to the United States in the form of apple juice concentrate, which destroys our market. And it comes in, and recently it's been coming in, as I've been told, and I'm not sure, I haven't verification of this because I don't have time to research this right now, but I've been told that it's been coming in sometimes through other countries. It gets checked into one country and then relabeled and sent on. That may or may not be true, I don't know. But in any case, it is the case that our apple prices are extremely low. And one of the reasons is so-called free trade, which is destroying. There's no doubt that free trade is destroying farming in this country, at least apple farming. That's, you know, they talk in the news about how it's the salvation, but that's just crap, in my view. It's just flat crap. So anyway, that's my view, and you can take it or leave it, but there it is. Okay, one final thing, and this is just a passing note. Do you think, this is from, there were women also, farm wives at some of these horticultural meetings, and there was this interview that appeared in there, and I don't have the whole interview, but I have just one question and answer. Mrs. Ralph Ballard of Niles, Michigan was being interviewed, and she also wrote this piece about how important farm life is and how wonderful it is and how city people don't understand it, but it really has its own inner rewards. And she quotes from Emerson, and she talks about family life and so on. And then there's this interview that follows it, and here's the question. Do you think it's necessary for a wife to take an interest in her husband's work on the farm? Answer, I think a certain amount of interest, perhaps not an interest in all the annoying things. And I just envision, this, well, anyway. Enough of that. So that's how things, in some respects, have not changed. Maybe have changed in some respects, depending. But then there's the question of how things have really changed. There was a book published in 1999 called by Stephen Blank, which is really a, and I don't mind saying this on the web, I'm perfectly happy saying that, from an academic point of view, in terms of documentation, it's a terrible book. It's really terrible in terms of documentation. And you can go look at it and check it out. It's true. It's really badly done. But the argument is good. In the sense that, it's a strong argument. I don't like the argument. But the argument is in the title, The End of Agriculture in the American Portfolio. His argument is that farming is simply something that we're going to have to just jettison in this country. And we're just going to have to live with that. We're going to import our food. We're going to not farm. Eventually, there'll be a few agribusinesses that grow for Kellogg's or something, and that's it. That's his argument. And he's dead serious. It's a very harsh book. It's a real hard book to read if you are invested in the family farm, as I am. But I'll tell you what, the statistics are not totally against him. And I'll give you some examples here. The prices that farmers received for their crops at the end of the 20th century were, for the most part, and I would say that's to a considerable degree true, lower than the prices they received for their crops 50 years earlier. Certainly in terms of adjusted for inflation, but in some cases, not adjusted for inflation. Then there's the question of loss of farmland. In the last decade, Michigan, of the 20th century, Michigan lost 2,000 farms, about 100,000 acres of farmland. In 1900, there were 5.7 million farms in the United States. 1920, which is the time that the house I live in was built, there were 6.4 million, which is the highest that there ever was in this country for farming. From that point on, it dropped. Dropped in 1930 to 6.2 million. By 1964, when that book, Yes, We Can Save the Family Farm, was written, it had dropped to 3.1. That's why he was writing it. Nothing that he writes about in that book has changed. Not one thing. That book is absolutely contemporary other than updating the statistics. Let's see here, 78, there were 2.2 million. 95, there were 2.0 million. 97, it was 2.07, 2.05. Down to around 2 million. And this doesn't talk about the disproportionate loss of vegetable and, orchard land, which is a unique kind of land. There's only certain kinds of land in Michigan. My family's farm we're very fortunate to have this kind of land. You cannot grow peaches near Grand Rapids in just any place. There's only certain kinds of places this far north that you can grow peaches. One of them is Peach Ridge. And the other is actually my family's farm, which is on the bottom end of the kind of glacial moraine that also, I guess that's what it's called, that goes up and becomes Apple Ridge or Peach Ridge, Fruit Ridge is what it's called, the apple growing, unique apple growing region. That area is totally devastated right now. Farms are going out that have been in multiple generation farms. It's a very difficult situation for a lot of growers. And you see this in terms of the actual numbers. A number of acres from 82 to 87 dropped from 1.14 million to 994,000. Vegetable growers' numbers have been diminishing continuously. In central and western Michigan, this county lost 36 square miles of farmland. Jackson County lost 84 square miles, Livingston lost 62 square miles, Shiawassee lost 47 square miles, and so forth. In my own family's area, you'll see in the book, I refer to areas. We call certain areas on the farm by different names that refer to the farmers who used to live there, who used to farm it. And we would buy up this patch or that patch, you know, and our farm is not a huge farm, but, you know, it's made up of smaller farms. So you've got, you know, Byron Muth, the O'Briens, the Schimmerhorns, the Grahams, Bill Hickey. Bill Hickey was growing apples kind of when I was young. He used to say, I remember back in 1936, I planted those trees with your grandfather. You know, and he sounded exactly like that. You know, he's the source of Apple Ridge Apartments, actually. I recognize the uniqueness of my family's farm, and that's what I wanted to convey. The reason I didn't want to do a reading is I wanted to give you a bracket for this book, you know, a context for the book. And that's really what I tried to do in this talk. The book itself is not at all what I just talked about. The book itself is, on one hand, I've had people tell me that actually they have cried reading the book. So there must be something about it that touches the emotions, right? But at the same time, I meant the book as a celebration, because the family farm to me is really something to celebrate, and that's what the book is about. It celebrates the people, all the characters who've worked on it, like Casey, who's sort of a bantam rooster of a guy who used to get in fist fights with people, and he'd get knocked out somewhere, and then we thought he was dead, and then he sort of came back from the dead. We have these guys who sort of, they work on the farm in the summer sometimes, and then they're gone, and then it seems like they're dead, and then they suddenly seem like they come back to life somehow and reemerge on the farm. These great characters like that, you know, and the land itself, it's a very precious thing, and that's what I'm trying to convey to people, because I think it's important to try to convey that. So what I say at the end of my remarks, actually, and this is the end of my remarks, where just about exactly on time, and I'll say this, I'll read the last three sentences. Although in many ways the way of life on the farm hasn't changed at all, as a testimony of these farmers from 1880 on shows, the land itself is being destroyed. What's being lost is a precious thing. In many respects, it's the foundation of American society. An island farm is meant to be testimony to it. So, read it and enjoy. So those are my remarks. I actually have more remarks, but first, I thought there'd be questions. So are there questions about any of this? Grandfather and grand, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, there was Jacobus James, and then the farm was somewhat divided between the families of on the one hand, the two brothers, Peter and Paul, who lived in houses on the opposite sides of the street, and their respective families. And then the family, the four brothers took over the farming, and those are Warren, Dave, Jim, and Phil. And they're the ones who've been farming. And now it's my cousin Pete, Peter Joe. There's another Pete, but he's a judge. He's not the one taking it over. Peter Joe is taking it over. And it's a good thing. So that's kind of the male side of the lineage. And I could go over the female side. My grandmother, Tina, was really important in terms of... because Peter died fairly young, and that was my grandfather. Well, not young, but he didn't die. He wasn't, I don't remember his exact age, but he died long before Tina did. So my grandmother was, you know, living in the main house for many years before she died. And so she was kind of the matriarch up in the main house, you know. So, I should add that side to it. Yeah, Ann. It's very unusual. I mean, I grew up in a very unusual situation. For one thing, I grew up with an extended family that came from 10 brothers and sisters all living in the same area. Really, I grew up in what amounts to a very characteristically European situation, transported to the U.S. Maybe Asian as well. I'm not really sure, but certainly it's Dutch, and so my family preserves Dutch words. We live in a very Dutch way in a lot of respects, and so it is unique. And I have photographs of my cousins and my cousins and me out there on the farm. And for all the world, these photographs are in black and white. For all the world, they look like they were taken in 1880. They weren't, but they're all these scruffy looking, people standing there with, the picking straps and, sort of wet after the picking the corn in the morning, and it's pretty in the background with the corn, they're all sort of standing there, We're all standing there, and it looks very 19th century, and it is unique. I'll say that. It's not like grain farming. It ain't like grain farming. Yeah. Yes. I don't even know if I really want to talk about that. honestly, that's really, all I can say is that up till now, of land that we have owned to farm, our farmed land, we have not sold any. And partly that's because, for a while, prices were pretty good, And the four brothers have a good working relationship, and things just worked okay. And the family gets along very well. So, it's been a unique situation. And as to the future, frankly, I can't say. I have my druthers, and there's an agenda in publishing the book Island Farm, There is an agenda, and part of that agenda is to say this is a unique place that ought to be preserved. And I think, there was a newspaper article about how, Michigan had somehow saved, I don't remember, 1,000 acres or something, like a couple farms maybe, through development right purchasing, which is nothing, And I'd like to push more in that direction. I actually joined the National Farmers Union this past year, also. What that's worth. I like them. They're a very cranky, curmudgeonly organization that, is very, they're very harsh in Washington. So that's another good thing. I became a lifetime member because I like their curmudgeonliness. So that might help too, because you need changes in the structure, in the way things work to some degree, I think, in order for farms like that to survive. It's very difficult. I don't delude myself about that at all. Well, not much. Maybe a little. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. Right. We can keep one farm in Michigan to kind of show us what happened. That's the argument of Stephen Blank. That's his argument. Maybe you have a show farm somewhere. Why do we need farming? And that's his argument. Import it all. Just become a food dependent, dependent on imports like we are becoming in oil. I mean, that's a totally possible argument. Most people don't particularly notice where their food comes from. I mean, where did those tomatoes that you just bought come from? Probably the Netherlands. Right. Might be Mexico. So, yeah, I mean, that's an argument. Dick Posthumus said the local grocery store went out in the 50s and, you know, the corner grocery store, and now it's farms time. You know, he said something like that at one point. You know, I'm sure he'd recant, hear me say that. You know. Yeah. And the impact of what? The Grange. Yeah, that had absolutely no impact in my family. Nothing. I mean, we're not Grange members, never had a Grange around there, don't pay any attention to it. You know, we're not big unionizers, we're not real interested in, you know, communication in general, probably. You know, I don't know. I mean, we're not that interested in that. We haven't been historically. My grandfather wouldn't have been. You know, my great-grandfather, I'm sure, temperamentally wouldn't have been. You know, the Grange were Granges were farmer organizations designed to allow for communication and also maybe for the kinds of things that I'm talking about in terms of organization. But unfortunately, you know, those kind of movements, particularly fruit farmers. Fruit farmers just don't want to do that kind of thing. You know, they don't. They tend not to want to. I mean, there are cases where they do, but they're relatively few, you know, and that's just how it is in my own experience. And maybe, I'm sure there are some other, there are some instances where that's not true. But here I'm just talking out of sort of collective family experience. Yeah. My great-grandfather actually was... you know, he was a younger member of a pretty good-sized family and couldn't make a living in the Netherlands. The family, we have really almost no connection to the Dutch wing of the family, although I was in the Netherlands and I have some stories about that. But my great-grandfather was actually a specialist in greenhouses, and he worked for the biggest, he actually was the manager of the biggest greenhouse at that time. I think in Grand Rapids, but certainly on the west side of Grand Rapids. And so he was a greenhouse, you know, nursery specialist. And that was something that he brought with him, you know. And then he bought this relatively poor land that people didn't want, and then he just built out from that. And then during the Depression, he went into Grand Rapids with a cart. My grandfather, and well, actually it was my great-uncle Paul, I guess he's what he'd be, who would go into Grand Rapids with a wagon and sell door to door in the Polish neighborhood, which is why in my family there's still Polish words, you know. There's a connection between the two. And people, I work on our fruit stand every Saturday. You come out to Grand Rapids on a Saturday, on the west side, you will see our fruit stand, and I will be in it. And occasionally, you know, elderly Polish women will come up and say, I remember your grandfather coming by to sell, and we really cared about that when he came by during the Depression, because that was our one thing. This Dutchman would come by and sell us apples. You know, that was one thing that was a treat during that period, and they really remembered it. You know, so that's sort of family, you know, lore too. Yeah. If I were going to wager on that, I would wager no. But I don't have any records, and it's totally possible. I would wager no just out of instinct. But I could be wrong. You know, it's totally possible. Yeah, there's no family stories about that. There's stories about getting up at 2 in the morning to go in to sell to the wholesalers who tried to screw you over. There's lots of stories about that, you know. But there's no stories about the fair, no. And I went to fairs as a kid, but it was because of my mother, not because of the, had nothing to do with the, and horses, had nothing to do with, yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, I totally believe that. And I would really urge you to come by and talk to, I think there's probably somebody that I could introduce you to and you could say that story to, you know. But I personally don't have, any sway over how things might or might not be done. So, you know, I can't personally on the land push. I can push toward that sort of thing, but I can't. Do you see what I'm trying to say here? There are other people who make decisions, and so how they want to make, what they want to do. Personally, you know, we're thinking about that kind of thing. Yeah, I would really encourage that kind of thing. Sure. Yeah, that's right. It's like somebody said.
It's like if you keep walking into a brick wall and every time your head
splits open, why? Yeah, I had somebody say in a totally different context, you know, if you're smashing your head against a wall day after day and eventually all you see are just brains and blood, you'd think you'd stop doing that. You know, this is in a totally different context, but, you know, maybe it. At the same time, it's not easy to do that. I mean, it's not easy also because we have a big farm. And it's not easy to make this kind of large-scale shift, particularly when you have ingrained ways of doing things. So yeah, it's difficult, you know. I really encourage that kind of change, and I think it would be a really good thing. But it is not an easy thing to do, particularly if there are ingrained ways of doing things. And here, you know, I mean, I have to be diplomatic in what I say, too, you know. I mean, to be honest, you have to understand that. But yeah, that would be nice. Well, it's not necessarily going down the wrong track. Yes. Yeah. 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 Well, it's more complicated than that. It's not like it's that the entire structure of the country works against family farming the way it is set up right now. I mean, really, what farmers would like, you know, family, I think the vast majority of family farmers would like to do is just farm. That's it. What's that? Until they organize. And farmers have simply not done that effectively. But the fact is, I mean, I've got a guy down the street I know pretty well who can barely make it, and he's, you know, he's holding his equipment together with wires, you know, and just barely making it, you know. And all he wants to do is just farm and hand it down to his kid. That's it. That's all he wants to do. And I'm really sympathetic with that. And part of the reason that isn't done is not, yes, it's, I think that's a good, innovations are good, all right? And I really do encourage that kind of thing and pushing in that direction. At the same time, it becomes extremely frustrating because it seems as though the policies of our government are completely counterproductive. And that becomes the more frustrating thing, because really the truth is farmers just want to farm, you know? I mean, that's just a fact. But they go out of business not because they're stupid. They're confronting the same things as they were in the past. They're farming things because those are the things you confront. This is life. You're confronting the same things when you farm, whether it's now or 200 years ago or 200 years from now, probably. You're confronting these same difficulties. But one difference is that this is my own view, because of free trade and what I think is very unfair trade, the market becomes flooded with things that you cannot compete against. We cannot compete against cheap Chinese apple concentrate. We can't do it. I can't. My family can't do it. So you're right that we need a change, but also it would be nice if we could compete on a level playing field. I mean, that would be nice. Yes. Yeah, and they're optimistic too.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Price goes up. In some way,
everything's great.
Right. It's like if there's apples in China, and the price of apples is going up, the pressure
of the
education
is going up. Right. Yeah, that's right. That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. Partly that's because, you know, most farmers, you know, the farmers that I know mostly farm just to farm. I mean, they farm because they love doing it. They love what they do. I know that's, I mean, I can name people and introduce you to them who farm because they love farming, period. That's it. And so farming is different than a lot of businesses, you know. It's not the same thing. That's just reality on the lived level, in my experience coming from a family farm, you know. And that's what I'm trying to convey in the book too, is that it's not just a business, it's something totally different. Yes. 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 Yes.
And these farmers are working lots of hours. A lot of them said their hours are down now from 18 hours a day a few years ago to coming down more to 10 and 12 hours a day. They're learning how to be smarter and developing the market. But it's not really positive.
Yes. I'm really glad you mentioned that, because Michigan State has the Organic Fruit Growers School, which I'm going to go to on March, what is it, 5th and 6th. And I'm really pleased that Michigan State is supporting that, and they're bringing in serious, you know, serious people, and have people like yourself here, and I think that's really encouraging. And I think there are really some positive signs, exactly like what you're talking about, you know. It is hard to change, but I think some change is going to have to happen over time, you know, and that's just a fact. I'd agree with that. There's one more thing I wanted to say. We have reached the end of our time, but before we're entirely done, I've got 1 minute. So in that 1 minute, I'm going to hand something out, because I'm acting director of this program here, residential program in the humanities, called ROYAL, which is Residential Option in the Arts and Letters. And it's a group of undergraduates in the humanities over in Abbott Hall. There's an agricultural a program in agriculture and natural resources called Bailey Scholars Program. And I've been trying to link to some modest ways Bailey and Royal. And the College of Arts and Letters and the College of Agriculture are actually joined together as co-sponsors of a speaker who's coming here in March. And I've got a flyer for you on that. It's Victor Davis Hansen, who's a family farmer. He's a great speaker. He was voted the best classics professor in the United States a few years ago. He's a classics professor. His specialty is family farming in ancient Greece and military history. But he's written 2 books on family farming and his own family farm and his experiences. And he's been likened to Ambrose Bierce. His book is funny. It's extremely intelligent. It's a great book, and so we are joining together to have a reading group, and we're going to have, so he's coming to speak on March 30th, on March 29th, on Thursday night, he's going to be speaking, and he'll be speaking on the humanities and agriculture and how he, in his somewhat exotic way, actually, joins the two, and on his experiences as a fruit grower in California and as a classics scholar. And he's written a couple best-selling books. One is Who Killed Homer? He was on PBS, interviewed. I mean, he's a pretty major figure. And we're going to read. We're creating a joint reading group to which everyone here is welcome. You get a 1/3 off the price of his book, his latest book, which is called The Land Was Everything, Letters from an American Farmer. We will have 2 reading discussions of maybe an hour, hour and a half beforehand. People who come to the reading discussions then will be invited to a roundtable discussion with Victor Davis Hansen on March 30th, which is a Friday morning. And that will be really good. I'm really looking forward to that. And by the way, we're actually going to have a couple of family farmers from Michigan show up there, apple farmers, so that fruit farmers. So that Hansen is going to be meeting a couple. I've never met him, but I'm interested in meeting him. He's one of the most active professors in the United States. So I'm just handing out this flyer here, and it's got some background information on that, and a website and so forth, and how to become part of the reading group if you want to. I really encourage you to do that if you have an interest in the possible confluence of agriculture and the humanities. I think this is something that Michigan State should really... You know, I was talking earlier with my wife about the whole question of reading groups and the fact that in the humanities, Gary, I'm talking to a colleague here, there ain't no reading groups, you know? Don't you find that weird? I mean, isn't that weird? It's very rare. You know, I was thinking back, you know, back to my time at graduate school at University of Michigan, there were no reading groups. I'm thinking in my different institutions, there's no reading. So I thought, what better way? You end up with a one-third off, probably first edition of his book, signed by the author, and a roundtable discussion with him. I mean, what could be better than that? So anyway, that's the pitch. That's it. There you go. There you go. Pass those down. And thank you all for coming. And make sure you get... Here, let me just pass these around. Make sure you get one of these.